Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how SNAP cuts are hitting Arizona kids and why it could get worse.
And will Arizonans have federal assistance to pay their heating bills this winter?
But first, the Scottsdale City Council this week once again declined to vote in favor of joining a lawsuit challenging a new state law. The measure essentially nullified a referendum in Scottsdale over a proposed development by Axon. The taser maker wants to build a new headquarters in North Scottsdale that would also include a hotel, restaurants, and most controversially, apartments. But residents collected enough signatures to refer the project, which had won city council approval, to the ballot. State lawmakers and the governor then approved the new law, which precludes that referendum. In response, a group called Taxpayers Against Unlawful Apartment Zoning Exemptions, or TASE, filed a lawsuit against that law. Leaders are hoping to get the Scottsdale City Council on board with that suit, but so far they've been unsuccessful. Bob Littlefield is chairman of TASE and a former city councilman. I spoke with him earlier and asked what happened at this week's city council meeting in which officials went behind closed doors to talk about this issue.
Well, it's interesting. After the executive session, the council came out and voted in open session, which is what they have to do. They can't vote in an executive session.
Right.
So they came out and they voted basically to do what they've done, I think, three or four times before, which is nothing more than kick the can down the road on this for another 2 weeks. They have asked, the city's legal department has asked the judge in the case for a two-week extension on the filing deadline. And I believe there's really no obvious logical reason for that. I believe that they're kicking the can down the road because they're trying to find a way to cut a deal with Axon. And the reason for that is this. This apartment development is ridiculously unpopular. So the people on the council who are pro-Axon, and why would they be pro-Axon? Because Axon has more money than the U.S. government. Well, actually, the U.S. government doesn't have any money, so that's probably a bad analogy. But they have a lot of money, and they made it clear during the last legislative session, during which they got their Axon bill passed, that they are not shy about spending that money on politicians for campaign contributions, surf and turf dinners, whatever it takes to get their way. So I think what they're going to try to do is they can't keep delaying this forever for joining the lawsuit. The judge will probably not agree on a second extension. So sometime toward the end of November, they're either going to have to join the lawsuit or they're going to have to say, hey, we're not joining it. So I think that what they're doing is they're hoping that sometime in between they can come up with a deal with Axon to negate all this. But the problem with that isn't really a compromise. It's a surrender, because the only way they're going to make that work is to give Axon everything they want. And the other thing is even if you were to accept the large number of apartments they're proposing, this still leaves open the issue of the fact that Senate Bill 1549, which is what we're suing the state about, would still be left intact and would still be nullifying the right of referendum for Scottsdale citizens.
Well, why is it so important to you that the city itself join the lawsuit? Like, you have your arguments, you have a lawsuit that you're going forward on. Why does it matter that the city joins as well?
Well, it would be our lawsuit would be more powerful and more effective if the city were a party, because without revealing some of the strategy, there are issues on which the city has better standing than a private organization. Now, we believe that we can probably win this without the city, but it would make it more impactful if the city would join. Plus, there's another thing. What message are you sending to the residents? If you're on the City Scottsdale City Council and you refuse to join the Taze lawsuit, that says to the citizens, hey, we don't care about you. We care more about Axon than we do about you, Mr. and Mrs. Scottsdale resident.
Let's say the council is trying to cut a deal with Axon. Is there any universe in which they might cut a deal that you would be happy with?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because the whole point of this, getting the signatures, the 26,000 signatures, and doing it, was to give the voters of Scottsdale the opportunity to weigh in on this. I mean, conceivably, we could have the referendum and Axon could win. I don't think that's going to happen. But there's a principle here, and the principle is that we've been working for years to get a city council, a city government that's resident-friendly instead of developer-friendly. And having this referendum in which the citizens will be able to go down and say either, yeah, I approve of this gigantic building, or I don't. That's really the principle that's at stake here.
I'm curious what you make of sort of the relationship at this point between Axon and Scottsdale and concerns that some city officials and others have pointed out about maybe Axon's going to leave and take the jobs and the, you know, the other development along with them. Is that something that concerns you?
No, for two reasons. First of all, having watched these Axon guys now, it's pretty clear to me that they are, there's no other way to say it, very arrogant, and they're not going to leave. I don't think so. But even if they did, here's the point. No private company is more important than the rules that Scottsdale has for development to try to keep Scottsdale special. All right? There's the principle involved here. These guys don't get to say, well, the rules don't apply to us. They apply to other people. They apply to, you know, Anner Health or whatever. But they don't apply to us.
And I guess at this point, like, what is your level of optimism that the city council will vote to join the lawsuit?
Oh, it's pretty low. You know, the mayor, and I probably should, the only reason I pick on her is this. Everybody else on the council has been clear one way or the other how they're going to vote, okay? The thing that annoys me about the mayor, she says over and over again publicly, I want to join the Taze lawsuit and fight Senate Bill 1549. But then every time she actually has an opportunity to do that, she votes no. So that tells me that she really doesn't want to do this. So there's at least four votes now to not do that and to not do it. So my level of optimism is low. We're going to have to win this on our own without the city council.
Bob Littlefield is a former Scottsdale City Councilman and the current chairman of the group Taxpayers Against Awful Apartment Zoning Exemptions. We also reached out to Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski for this story. Her office responded and asked for specifics, which we provided, but they did not respond to that by deadline.
Tuesday was Election Day in Arizona, and most of the issues on your ballot were likely to do with funding schools. Lots of school districts across the state asked voters to pass bonds and overrides to boost their funding. And as we've learned, as the results have rolled in over the last 48 hours or so, it's come to mixed results. Here to tell us more is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so this was a bit of a mixed bag. Lots of places like Phoenix and Tempe passed their bonds and overrides pretty easily. Kind of more liberal enclaves with pro-public education votes. Is that right?
Yeah, right now we've got about 16 of the 27 total bond and override questions on there that are look like they're in place to pass. Most of those with comfortable margins in places like you mentioned. There's a few in Chandler and Deer Valley that are kind of right there on the line, and we still have about 90,000 votes to count countywide. So those are the only two that really look like they might be able to flip at this point.
Okay. Let's zoom in on one district where their bond and override proposals failed pretty spectacularly. This is the Tolleson Union High School District. What do the numbers look like in that race right now?
Yeah, Tolleson was going out for a bond and an override, and both are failing by a large margin as of Wednesday night. As you mentioned, 60 to 40 on the bond, pretty similar on the override. And that's really surprising because Tolleson is really one of those places that has historically passed these type of ballot measures.
Yeah.
Just last year, the elementary school district in the area passed an override, and then the high school district has had bonds passed multiple times in the past, like 3 years.
Okay, but there is sort of a wild card here, which is that this is a district that's been in the news a lot lately and for questions about financial mismanagement and a proposed $80 million domed football stadium.
Yeah, they've really become the ire of the state legislature, especially Republicans down there, but some Democrats as well, because of a plan to bail out the nearby Isaac School District. It was kind of like a building swap and lease back situation, and lawmakers didn't really think that was the role of the school district, is to bail out another school district that seemed to have issues managing their finances. And then on top of that, Superintendent Jeremy Kaya has announced this plan to build an $80 million football stadium. So, yeah. Not a great look when you're asking for more money to run your district, but then you're kind of doing these other financial things that create concerns in the community. And it's really showing at the ballot that the community is concerned about those things. Because like I said, they've passed these things over and over again, and now they're failing by a pretty good margin.
How much would this bond and override have been for? Like, why did district leaders say they needed it?
It would have been about $125 million. And it's the typical type of bond we see. You know, the bond pamphlets are pretty generic in terms of what they're telling you, you know, new school buildings, new facilities, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. On the bond side and on the override, teacher pay and funding for electives and arts and sports and transportation and all that kind of stuff. But again, that's kind of the source of this problem, too, because apparently bond money would have been going to pay for this stadium, but no bond pamphlet in the past they've approved or asked for three bonds in the past 3 years, and no pamphlet ever specifically said we're going to use this for a sports stadium.
Hmm. Okay, let's move on and talk for a minute about the Kyrene School District, Wayne, where their override was successful with voters, but there was a lot of pushback there against it, which is pretty out of the ordinary.
Yeah, in Kyrene, they've actually passed these overrides since the 1980s continually. So, you know, a lot of support for public education in that district and passing these things. But, you know, the district is now talking about closing schools due to enrollment declines and associated, you know, projected budget shortfalls. And so now there are some more people in the community saying, hey, do we need our property taxes going up even more or continuing to stay elevated to fund this thing when, you know, now the district is looking like it's closing schools. They want some answers on that front. It still looks like it's passing by a pretty significant margin, mm-hmm. but you definitely saw some like comments in that voter booklet on the negative side, bringing up the issues the district has faced recently.
Yeah. I mean, so same question, right? Like, why do district leaders say that they need this when, you know, they are closing schools? Like, why would they need more money in a time in which they're having fewer students come?
Yeah, it's important to note the difference between a bond and an override. A bond largely is for these big one-time capital expenses. So think building new school buildings, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. Maybe some huge maintenance projects. But the override is really, it's increasing the maintenance and operations budget. So that, like I said, teacher salaries, funding for full day kindergarten is what a lot of districts use it for, or electives and special programs. And so it really becomes a part of the district's budget. And so, as I said, Kyrene has had these in place since the 1980s.
Yeah.
So in effect, it's a budget cut if the voters approve it for decades and then all of a sudden don't. So that's really why the district leaders say they need it. This happened a few years back in Scottsdale, and mm-hmm. they saw a bunch of programs cut. And then the next time it came to the ballot, voters went back and approved it.
Interesting. Okay. All right, Wayne, one more bond to talk about quickly this morning for WestMEC. This is the Western Maricopa Education Center. It has campuses focused on career training across the West Valley. They're asking for a pretty big bond to do a pretty major expansion. This is to the tune of $415 million.
Yeah, that's right. And the bond itself is currently passing as well, but by one of those narrow margins and with so many votes left to count, you know, I wouldn't call it a slam dunk at this point. They're also asking for approval to sell some land. Both basically would be to expand the programs. They're saying this is very popular, you know, we're bringing in more students, career and technical education, so we need to build more campuses, we need to expand programs.
But they've also faced some criticism of late as well, right?
Yeah, and this isn't quite the same as some of the other districts. I didn't see really much organized opposition to this, but they there was a state audit earlier this year that felt that they were holding on to too much money. Essentially, they had money in the bank that they could have been spending, but they're just kind of sitting on it. So again, when you're going out and asking for more money to do things, but you got money in the bank, that doesn't always sit well with one. And they also could have been paying out more money to some of their partners at high schools and stuff that helped them run the programs.
Wayne, let me ask you lastly sort of a broad question, right? Because none of these bonds or overrides would cost like individual taxpayers a whole lot of money. But it seems like voters are starting to push back on these in a way that maybe they didn't used to. Like, it's not necessarily a given anymore that a district will get a bond or an override when they put one on the ballot.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are some districts in the West Valley and parts of the East Valley that are voting them down and have historically voted them down. So it's not a surprise, but you're starting to see a little bit closer elections in some other suburbs. And that is based on the fact that, yeah, maybe the individual bond isn't going to raise your taxes by all that much. But when you start seeing them compounded on top of each other, like we did in Tolleson, or I said they like have voted three in a row, and then you add some sort of controversy or question about financial management on top of that, that can really hurt voters. But again, as I mentioned, especially on the override side, this is like how we fund public education right. in Arizona. It is a key part of the budget for so many districts. I mean, we had a court ruling that actually said that lawmakers aren't funding education adequately in violation of the state constitution. And one of the things the judge pointed out was that so many districts rely on these extra voter approved funds just to like stay above water, essentially.
Right, right. Okay. Lots to watch for as these results continue to come in. We'll leave it there for now, though. That is KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the life-saving power of chess.
But first, as the federal shutdown drags on, SNAP recipients remain in limbo this morning. A federal judge ordered the Trump administration to release contingency funds to pay the benefits, but then the president himself posted on social media that he would withhold the benefits until the shutdown ends, which would be in violation of multiple court orders. The White House seemed to contradict that, but even if the administration pays the benefits to the millions of Americans who rely on them to eat, there will likely be a delay, and folks probably won't get all of the money they're used to. But as pundits debate the merits of safety net programs like this and accuse folks of milking the system, our next guest wants folks to remember one thing. A big chunk of the people who benefit from SNAP are kids. Chantel Meek is the executive director of the Children's Equity Project at Arizona State University, and she told me cuts to SNAP and early childhood education programs like Head Start will hit Arizona children hard, especially because we are starting from so far behind.
One in four kids in Arizona rely on SNAP benefits. I think 40% of SNAP funding in Arizona goes to feeding children. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, disabled folks, elderly folks, veterans, a whole number of other categories as well. And it is the most basic need, right? It is food. And so, of course, you know, childhood hunger is associated with a whole range of outcomes in health and education and all sorts of things, because you can imagine if you're hungry, right, that impacts your health, that impacts the extent to which you're able to focus or do anything else.
So basic need, a whole lot of kids in Arizona yep. are going to be impacted by this. One of the ways they might make up for that, right, is eating at school, right?
Right?
But we're also looking at potential cuts to, and some cuts already in place in our state, to Head Start due to this federal shutdown.
Right. Just like school-age kids rely on school lunch in the K-12 space, young children who are living in poverty rely on Head Start for meals. Head Start provides nutritious breakfast, nutritious lunches, and nourishment for kids as part of the program. And so we are also seeing potential risk there, right? I think in Arizona, about 23% of our preschoolers who are living in poverty attend Head Start programs. Mm. And so that's a really big chunk of our kids living in poverty who, right, if we don't have SNAP, right, there's going to be impact for food on the table at home if they don't have Head Start, right? That doubly impacts their access to nutrition and food.
So that's the potential impact of
yep.
just even brief pauses to funding for Head Start, for SNAP. We didn't even get to Medicaid yet, which is facing cuts in the future as well. But let's back up for a moment, Chantel, and just talk about where Arizona's starting place was. Like, how does Arizona compare nationally in terms of child poverty and the kind of various impacts of that?
Yeah, so Arizona's child poverty rate right now is about 15%, which is pretty similar to the national average. That's still about 228,000 or a quarter of a million kids in poverty in our state. The Annie E. Casey Foundation ranks states on child well-being. And what we found, what they found when they published their most recent report earlier this year, was that Arizona was unfortunately ranked 42nd in child well-being.
Yeah, I mean, give us a sense of where these kinds of cuts intersect with that already kind of bad starting point, right? Like, what kind of perfect storm are we looking at?
Well, look, I mean, to start at a national level, just real quick, right? This organization called Children's Focus does an analysis of the federal budget every year. And they look at the percent of the budget that goes to kids and programs that serve kids. They just published their recent one last week, and about 8.87% of the federal budget goes toward kids stuff.
Okay.
Kids make up about 22% of the population, for reference. So that's already low, right? As a country, we're not doing a great job. In Arizona, we're doing worse, and we're below the average in a lot of different areas. So if we think about education, for example, this isn't a secret. The state is ranked 49th in investing in education. We're almost the worst state in the nation in high school graduation, with the exception of New Mexico. If we think about early education, only about 3% of kids in the state are served by state-funded pre-K. We rank about 44th in that domain, right?
Yeah.
We talked about Head Start already, but there are states that invest directly in Head Start to boost the number of their kids in poverty in the state who are receiving that kind of service. But we don't do that. So we can go on and on, right? But across many of these domains, education, child care, early education, health insurance coverage, health care, cash assistance, and socioeconomic stability, we're just starting from behind and have a lot of ground to make up to even get to the national average. And then you layer on top all the federal stuff coming down, where we're not in a great place.
So during this shutdown, as we're looking at these cuts, even if they're temporary, what communities might be impacted most? Like, I'm imagining tribal lands, rural Arizona, you know, probably has a lot more kids who benefit from these programs.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually looked at this data recently and found that Head Start plays a major role in early education in rural communities. In some counties, Head Start makes up 60%, 70%, in one county, upwards of 90% of the available childcare slots for families.
90%.
So if Head Start goes away, that the bottom falls out, right? Especially in our rural communities.
I want to ask you a little bit about your thoughts on why this is, that Arizona is at this place when it comes to kids and childhood poverty issues. I mean, is this really about money, about funding choices? Or is this, you think, something deeper about, like, the way people here regard children, vulnerable communities in general?
I wish I knew the answer to that. You know, as I started with a little bit earlier, this is, of course, like, we don't do enough. We don't prioritize kids in budgets or in policy at the federal level. Many of those safety net programs that we've talked about, those basic need programs, have never been fully funded to serve all kids, including Head Start. But at the state, I think we have just had a really hard last couple decades. You know, we definitely saw some dips during the recession in the 08 and 09 period. And a lot of it has been, you know, as we've recovered from that as a country and as a state, like, come out of that recession, we just never put the money back or increased the money or kept up with the pace of, you know, all these other states, right? Universal pre-K or statewide pre-K hasn't been around in every state forever. It's just that we stayed still and a lot of other states moved forward over the course of the last couple decades. And so we see the same type of pattern across various different children's programs, that we just have not invested in kids and reinvested from those dips.
Let me ask you, lastly, a little bit of a speculative question. But one of the big fears with this government shutdown, I think, from folks like you who advocate for, you know, these issues, is that these cuts, while they may be temporary during the shutdown, will turn into permanent cuts. What would be sacrificed in that case? And even in a short-term sense, during a shutdown, what will be sacrificed if states in the end have to kind of make up for those gaps?
Well, it's really hard to think about what would be sacrificed in a state that already invest so little in early childhood programs and in K-12 spending and in general in programs that help kids and families. And so it's really hard to speculate on that. I know that this conversation is happening in other states that have invested, for example, in universal pre-K, right? Like, do we have to pare back on that in order to mitigate some of the harms that families are going to face because of Medicaid cuts or because of SNAP cuts that will come into play after H.R. 1.
But we don't even have universal pre-K here. We don't even have universal kindergarten here.
Which is why I'm struggling to figure out, like, what K-12 is always a fear, right? And I feel like that is the fun that we always kind of default to that and pulling money there. So it's really hard to imagine what else, how far down we can go from where we're already at.
All right. Chantel Meek is the executive director of the Children's Equity Project at Arizona State University. Chantel, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Parts of Arizona are starting to see temperatures dip. Overnight lows in Flagstaff are forecast to be in the 30s for the next week before dropping into the 20s. But with the federal government shut down, home heating assistance money is not available. The Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, exists to help cover heating or cooling costs, but not, as it turns out, during a shutdown. With me to talk more about this is Courtney Fieldman, Director of Utility Programs at the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project. And Courtney, what are you hearing from states across the region about LIHEAP, about what they're able to do or maybe not able to do to help people heat their homes?
I think the short answer is everything right now is on hold or frozen. The funding technically exists on paper, but it's frozen in practice. So right now, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, is effectively stuck in states like Arizona. So Congress did actually appropriate, the $4 billion nationwide, and about $378 million of that is still undistributed since the April layoffs. And when we look at those numbers, like specifically in Arizona, Arizona should receive about $30 million of that to help about 27,000 households keep their homes heated or cooled. So the scale of this is pretty significant. And when the federal employees, running that program were laid off, there was no one left to manage it or communicate with states. So when the federal government did shut down, the few remaining staff who, were in charge of processing those transfers were sent home. So Arizona's Department of Economic Security and local community action agencies, they can still take applications, but they can't actually release those payments until the shutdown ends. So while the money, technically exists, this delivery system for the states has stalled, and families who applied weeks ago are still waiting to receive that.
Is that money frozen in federal accounts or in state accounts?
Yeah. So it's really more in state. It's the transfer from federal to state agencies. These state agencies are set up to actually receive those payments. And so when they were laid off, the system was already struggling to get those funds out of the door. So now with the shutdown, even the small number of people still waiting to process state transfers are unable to work, which means the entire funding chain is paused. So normally each fall, the Department of Health and Human Services reviews state plans, signs the grant agreements, and releases funds for the winter season. But that process is on hold. So for local community action agencies, the one who helps families pay their bills, this means that they can't draw down federal dollars to process approved applications. They're ready to help, but they don't have access to the funds. And so those families, it's really just this silent crisis, right? Their bills are due, but the aid can't be issued. And so I would say the real impact, it isn't just delay. It's really disruption. Every week we see the shutdown continue, the administration backlog grows. And once the government reopens, states will have to start restarting those approvals and reprocess payments before any aid can actually reach those households.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if this is the kind of thing that once the shutdown ends, that the money can quickly go to where it's needed, but it sounds like it can't.
Absolutely. So even once the government reopens, it takes time to restart the system. It takes time to rehire staff, reauthorize contracts, and reissue grants. So the shutdown doesn't just pause help. It's really this series of delay that could last into the new year. So for families, we're talking about that means extra late fees, or in some cases, even disconnection notices. And for local agencies, I think it means tighter budgets and tough decisions about who to prioritize first when funding actually does arrive.
So I know that there are some states around the country that are trying to sort of step into the void here and fill some of this, backfill some of this money. Are there any states in this region that are in a position to do so?
Historically, I would say no. And I would say that is one of the challenges. Potentially. So LIHEAP's funding formula was built around heating needs back in the 1980s. So you're seeing these colder northern states tending to get a larger share of that, mm-hmm. even though we're seeing extreme heat now as one of the biggest weather-related killers, especially in Arizona. So cooling costs are just as life critical as heating costs elsewhere. And so I think that's really where the work I'm doing at SWEEP and others have been urging to really modernize this so that federal programs, you know, recognize heat risk as a public health issue on par with winter cold. And so until that happens, I think you're seeing some states that are getting less of a fair share than others, even as we're seeing the need grow.
Obviously, as you reference, you know, when you think about Arizona, you tend to think about cooling costs. But there are, of course, places in the northern part of the state and, you know, outside of the desert areas that where it does get pretty cold and is starting to get pretty cold. I know some of the low temperatures, for example, in Flagstaff for the next several days are predicted to be, you know, right around freezing. What are communities like that supposed to do? What are, you know, families living in places like that who can't afford their heating bills supposed to do right now?
Yeah, and I feel like everything that we're saying really sounds bleak, but I just want to highlight that there are, you know, opportunities, and that for anyone listening, you know, there are places to turn. So if you or someone you know depends on LIHEAP, let's say, you know, the Arizona Department of Economic Security is still accepting applications. So once the shutdown ends, those payments will still be processed retroactively. So it's important to stay in that queue. In the meantime, utilities like APS and SRP, they offer hardship and limited income rate programs. You can even call 211, Arizona's Heat Relief Network. They can connect families to cooling centers and emergency bill support. These local programs are still running and can help until federal funds resume. But I think one of the bigger things and part of the story here is that, you know, Arizonans or, you know, other states shouldn't have to wait on Washington every time there's a funding delay. I think SWEEP is really working with utilities to have the capacity to actually build programs that help these families have access to things like insulation, better air sealing, or smart thermostats that can help efficiently control energy use and cost years round. These are local solutions that don't stop when the government does. And so more than anything, I would just like to call out that this is really a moment for Arizona and for some of the state utilities and regulators to actually start to strengthen these local efficiency and affordability programs so that these families can count on steady, affordable energy no matter what is happening in D.C.
We talked about the layoffs in the office that administers LIHEAP. Is there an expectation of whether or not this program will even exist in another couple of years?
I don't think so. This program has been operating as a bipartisan program since the 1980s. I don't think that there's any risk that we're going to actually see this program cease to exist. But I do think that we need to work a little bit on the mechanisms to ensure that there's stability so that it's not so much of a roller coaster for families who depend on it.
All right. That is Courtney Fieldman, Utility Program Director with the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project. Courtney, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Ellen DeMink had expected to retire as an anthropologist at the National Park Service. That is, until she was fired, along with about 1,000 of her colleagues earlier this year, one of the many casualties of the Trump administration's DOGE cuts. She knows that the work of cultural anthropologists at the national parks isn't well known, but she thinks it's incredibly important. Her last role there was as the coordinator for NAGPRA in the NPS's Southeast region. That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. In her role, she helped return cultural belongings to the tribes they rightfully belong to nationwide. Demink was able to get a new job working as an anthropologist in the private sector after she was fired. But now she fears that work and much more will go undone, and the consequences of that could be hard to undo. She wrote about it for the online magazine Sapiens and spoke with me more about it. I asked her first about her firing. Did she know it was coming?
Yes and no. When the administration was first turning over, obviously this isn't the first time we've been under this administration, and so there was some folks felt like they kind of knew what to expect, and it was kind of a keep your head down approach. We're the National Park Service.
Yeah.
There's a lot of public support for the work we do, which there continues to be, and that's been of great benefit, I think, to what preservation continues. But as time went on and more agencies were conducting layoffs, and especially around this notion of probationary employees, which I fell into that category, I started my most recent position in June of 2024. So I was about 4 months shy of that 1 year mark where I would have moved out of probationary. Yeah. Probationary had nothing to do with our performance. It was just within the 1 year timeline. So when it actually happened, it was absolutely a gut wrench. This has been something I had been working towards. It was my career plan. I expected to do this until I retired.
Wow. So, I mean, obviously it hit you hard. Tell us about the impact on the office. I mean, how many other people went with you? Was it everyone gone in the same day?
Thankfully, it wasn't everyone, but it was a high proportion at my office. I think there were about 12 folks at the office who were on that initial probationary layoff. I don't know the exact numbers that accepted the reinstatement that ended up happening. I was not one of those. I had kind of already started to make plans because it was so uncertain what was going to happen. I have some connections, and I think people are still holding out as long as they can because it's something that people are really passionate about, their work, but they also have to make decisions about what's going to be best for them and their families.
Are you angry?
I am. I am.
Yeah.
For myself, for my colleagues that also lost out on their dream jobs, for my colleagues that are still trying to hold down the fort, trying to continue work they're passionate about, but no longer being supported in that to whatever extent they were supported before.
Mm-hmm.
I know people are doing three times the jobs trying to fill the space. No one's obviously getting paid anymore. No one's getting paid at all right now.
Yeah.
And I think there was so much growth that still needed to happen in relationships between the government and tribes and other descendant communities that hold public lands sacred and important and significant. There's always going to be more work to do, and it's a slow process, and we just got knocked back 30 years.
So obviously you feel like your work was cut short and at a time when it seemed like it was kind of headed in the right direction for you. Why do you think that it's important that this kind of work exists at the National Park Service to begin with? Like that you wrote, it maintains an anthropological perspective. There's a history of erasure, basically, of these cultures and these practices.
Yeah, all Park Service lands were Indigenous lands and continue to have connections to the first peoples that stewarded them, that called them home, that had a relationship with them. There have been subsequent communities that also maintain strong cultural connections to these places. But in order for them to become Park Service units, people were removed forcibly or potentially voluntarily. And without them there, there's an element of what made these places important in the first place that's been erased. And so at least approaching public land stewardship with an anthropological perspective, with a sociological thinking about the humanity of these lands, provides space for elevating those stories, reigniting those connections. I don't believe that they've been wholly snuffed out in the first place, but giving them room and space to grow and reconnect. I think there's an element of relevancy that is uplifted with an anthropological perspective. It answers people's questions of why do we care about these places?
Yeah.
It has to be more than that. They're beautiful for people to really care and want to continue to protect them.
So what do you want people to know? Like, what do you want people to know about the work that you did, but also the work that you fear will not be done now?
I think the main thing is I want people to know that anthropologists exist within the world of public land stewardship. Cultural anthropologists, I think most people are familiar through popular culture, what an archaeologist does.
Yeah.
The subfield of cultural anthropology, I don't think people are as well versed in, but that they are there, even if you don't see them when you're visiting a park. But a lot of the information that you're learning about, a lot of the preservation of the natural landscape is impacted by the knowledge sharing cultural anthropologists. When they highlight the connections that other people have to these places, they also can help put a light on the fact that there are multiple ways of knowing and multiple ways of caring for places and making sure that there's a more holistic way to approach land stewardship.
What do you say to those who might say, you know, the administration was right in this, the federal government was too big, there are too many workers, the work that you're doing was not essential?
I thankfully haven't had to have any of those personal conversations, so I don't know exactly what I would say. I think I would have a hard time not getting flustered.
Yeah.
I mean, when it was all happening, there were lots of statistics coming out of like the wage of federal employees was 4% of our budget. The parks are extremely understaffed and have been for decades. People's experiences at the parks, their sustainability, their existence is only going to be improved when there are people that are there to do the work and have support. There was the Section 106 consultation hearing with the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources on Wednesday. And I think something I heard out of it multiple times was that it's not the process, it's the fact that there's no one there to do it. So if there's if there's slowdowns, how does having fewer people help that?
It's interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Ellen DeMink, an applied anthropologist, former NAGPRA coordinator for the Southeast region at the National Park Service, joining us. Ellen, thank you for coming on and telling us about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. As a young boy, Danny Rench dreamed of being a chess prodigy. It wasn't just that he was obsessed with the game. Chess seemed like an escape from the extreme circumstances of his childhood. Rench was born into the Church of Immortal Consciousness, a spiritual community based in Tonto Village, not far from Payson. Rench says the group was a cult, and in his new memoir, Dark Squares, he tells the story of how chess became a pathway out of the group's clutches. Rench would go on to become one of the most celebrated chess players in the world, but not without some heartbreaking sacrifices along the way. He spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman about the game's unique appeal and how, as a kid, he spent hours reading every single chess book he could get his hands on.
Every single page had some sort of hidden gem or some sort of knowledge that I was just about to get. I felt like there were secret lessons just waiting to be passed down if you only would just keep reading. And I think chess really was one of the first games that we started documenting. And when you start documenting and tracking not just every single game result, but the moves, I just understood right away that there was kind of something magical to this idea that there was an evolution within the board and that your own understanding could improve just by learning the secrets and or learning from the mistakes of sort of the masters of the past, if you will.
Yes. There's this fixed reality, which is a board with a set number of squares, set number of pieces, each of which has prescribed movements. But within those limitations, there's all these infinite variations that can unfold.
And even as we sit here today with AI and machine learning, and as I've joked many times on different shows, we can put a man on the moon, but we can't solve chess, which is a game of complete and limited information. It's not even a game with luck, where you're calculating the odds of the possibilities you actually are not in control of. Chess is a game where you are in full control, and yet you, in many ways, are sort of surrendering the fact that you inherently can't control it, because you can never see all the way to the end, and you can't fully solve the unsolvable.
There is a resonance there between that idea and the environment that you were raised in, which mm-hmm. was this cult called the Church of Immortal Consciousness, where the central teaching was that there was this 15th century doctor who, one of the founders of this cult, was able to channel and speak to you directly, as kind of passing down this ancient wisdom. Do you see an alignment there?
I was born into and then literally raised under the premise of honoring those who've come before you, and having an appreciation that there is wisdom that if you're open to it, you can benefit from. Chess is interesting because chess also, I can say, having been raised in a cult, has a very religious following where people, for lack of a better term or lack of a better comparison, they tend to worship the game, and they tend to fall almost at times victim to their own sort of obsession with the unsolvable nature.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is something I wanted to ask you about. You do this really lovely thing in the book where between the chapters of your story, there are these little interludes where you're kind of tracing the history of chess and its evolution. And in those interludes, it feels to me, at least as a reader, you're nodding towards what you were just describing, this idea that chess as a kind of beautiful ideology with a mystery at the center has all of these imperfect systems grow up around it, which is also a way of describing a cult, maybe?
Well, I think one of the things about chess that is, to your point, chess is fascinating precisely because every single moment there is a right decision, and yet throughout the entire maze, you are almost guaranteed to go wrong at one point.
Yeah.
And I believe that spirituality itself, even religious storytelling, can be very healthy if used to help people ask life's biggest questions, like, why am I here? And how can I have a meaning? How can I make meaning and have an impact? The moment anyone tells you they have the answers to those questions, and certainly all of those questions, is where any religion has the potential to become a cult. Because the moment you pretend that anything is infallible or somehow above the right to your own skepticism, I believe that is the slippery slope where I saw for myself and experienced it, where you can give away your own agency in the process and ultimately not be served by those who are pretending to have the answers. And so there's a very interesting kind of human predicament within the game itself.
It seems like, in addition to you having an intuitive sense that chess was maybe your lowercase p purpose, it ends up being decided for you within the church that chess is, in fact, your capital P purpose. Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the tension between those two things, because it is very significant.
At some point, as I was progressing as a young player and became an All-American under the auspices of another part of the spiritual frameworks, which is that we are spiritual beings having a physical experience, and our spirit is here to achieve a purpose. And if we know what that purpose is, everything else should be secondary. And not only secondary, if it's in any way evaluated or deemed to be impeding on your purpose being the most successful possible, that it should be removed. And this includes not just intimate relationships, but biological relationships. And this dynamic had kind of existed, but never in the way that it came down explosively for me, which was that at the age of 12, I was told that my purpose was chess, which was kind of a big deal in terms of it meaning that nothing else mattered. No schooling mattered. No relationships would matter if they weren't supporting me becoming the best chess player in the world, essentially, and becoming a world champion. And at one point, not having the best chess tournaments here and there, I was separated and taken away from my mom. And my mom, for her part, was complicit in the idea that she was also under the same sort of brainwashing, that if she was standing in the way of my purpose, she wouldn't want to do that either. And I wouldn't speak to her for 10 years.
Well, in closing, Danny, I wonder if you could read us a brief section from the book that I think speaks to a lot of what you were just mentioning. This is at the bottom of page 113.
Sure. If anyone in the collective ever asked me how I was doing, I would say, I'm good. Look at my chest. Look how I'm performing. No, I don't miss my mom. If they pushed, I'd give some paraphrased version of, my purpose in God comes first. Who is my mother? Who is my father? The reality was that my earaches were getting worse. I was crying myself to sleep almost every night because I was a broken child who wanted to be with his mommy. But I had learned how to lie about how I felt, to everyone else, and, eventually, to myself. I said it over and over again. And at a certain point, the lie became truth. I died 1,000 deaths to get there, hiding from people and crying in my bed at night. But eventually, I no longer missed my mom. I had mourned her, because she might as well have been dead to me.
Well, Danny Rentsch is the chief chess officer at chess.com and the author of the book Dark Squares, How Chess Saved My Life. Danny, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks, Sam.
And that's it for today. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.